Good afternoon. I've never been to this conference before. I'm delighted to see so many people. Nor have I ever given a PowerPoint presentation before, so this is going to be a first for me. I want to thank Joe Rollins over here for putting the slides together for me. And I want to thank friends and neighbors and others that I've just met, other ordinary people. But we've got a lot to cover, and I would like to leave some time for questions, but I'm told that that's what tomorrow morning is for if I run out of time. But I think we're pretty much going to get through what I have prepared. As you can see, I'm going to talk about five anomalies. One thing that everyone agrees on is that the Book of Mormon is the keystone of the church. This imagery has been stated time and again throughout the church, beginning with Joseph Smith. A keystone, of course, is that wedge-shaped stone at the crown of an arch that locks the other pieces in place. Remove it, and the arch collapses. Now, if you haven't seen this keystone, you should visit Gilgal Gardens. It's on 5th South, just east of 7th East on the north side of the street. It's free. It's usually open, I think. And it's very interesting, but it's got this, among other things. Given this, that it's the keystone of the church, it is critical that we know whether or not the Book of Mormon is true. Moroni in the Book of Mormon tells the reader how to know whether the book is true by asking God, quote, with a sincere heart, with real intent, having faith in Christ, and he will manifest the truth of it unto you by the power of the Holy Ghost. Even though defenders claim to follow Mormon's counsel, many of them have proffered much evidence of the book's truth, including historical, archaeological, linguistic, literary, and other data. Critics have disputed it all and offered evidence of their own, which defenders have in turn challenged. Today, there is so much written on the subject that few can wade through it all and come to any firm conclusion on the question. Before I describe some of my own evidence, I should tell you how I got into this seeming chaos and the church and the research method I used. When I was in my late teens and 20s, a long time ago, probably before many of you were even born, I wondered whether the Book of Mormon was true. I had read Fon Brody's No Man Knows My History, published in the 1940s and one of the few critiques around at that time. Most of the other Mormon books then had been written by defenders such as Hugh Nibley, who challenged Fon Brody with his, "No ma'am, that's not history." In 1962, after practicing law in Salt Lake City for 3 years, I joined the IBM legal department in New York City. There was in the air at that time a question about the significance of the changes in the Book of Mormon between the first edition and the then-current 1920 version. Critics contended that the changes discredited the book, while defenders argued that the changes only corrected typographical errors or improved the grammar and meant nothing. My wife and I had earlier acquired in Salt Lake City a reproduction of the first edition of the Book of Mormon, and we set out to determine whether the critics or defenders of the book were right. Each evening, I would read the current edition aloud while my wife noted each change in the first edition. When we finished, we had the facts. That alone was enormously satisfying. We knew what each change was and how many there were, although we did nothing more with them since they weren't conclusive of anything in our mind. They affirmed what each side had found, that there were anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 changes, depending on how you counted them. Few, if any, of them corrected typographical errors, but most of them did improve on backwoods English, such as the change from this they done to this they did. A few of them seemed to change the meaning, although defenders insisted they were just clarifications. Having the facts was, as I've said, enormously satisfying. They were facts about which I could be certain. Unlike most, if not all, external evidence that characterizes history, archaeology, linguistics, and other disciplines, they were a complete set of facts, again, unlike external evidence where new facts are discovered all the time. I needed no special training to examine them, no advanced degree in archaeology, history, or linguistics, for example, and they were readily accessible to me and to anyone else who wanted to check my facts. Indeed, I spent the next 14 years indexing every word in the Book of Mormon, long before computers were available for this. At the end of the 14 years, in 1976, I had 8 boxes. Here's one of the 8. I had 8 boxes of 3x5 cards that recorded each word in the Book of Mormon, where it was used and how it was used, and 3 big binders. This is one of the binders. You're not supposed to notice it's an IBM stolen. Containing my research on the Book of Mormon, such as names, prophecies, biblical matters, and so forth. Since my initial foray into this morass, there has been an abundance of research on the Book of Mormon. It goes back to the 60s and 70s when Dialogue and Sunstone premiered and the Foundation for Ancient Research in Mormon Studies, or FARMS, was started at BYU. The research has engaged the talents of many scholars. Books have been written, articles published, papers presented, debates held, and so forth. The abiding issue addressed by much of this activity is the historicity of the Book of Mormon. My paper today is another in this long history of research, but is based on a close examination of the book itself, or internal evidence. Now, I find external evidence very interesting, and I've read much of what has been produced in the past 50 years, and some even preceding that. All of this research looks at one aspect or another of the Book of Mormon, and much of it has been helpful in my own research. But as interesting as the external evidence is, and it is, my paper deals with just what we can learn from studying the book itself. These are facts about which I can be certain. They are complete and unchanging. They are a complete and unchanging set of facts. They are accessible to everyone, and they require no advanced degree to study. What has my study revealed regarding authorship of the book? Well, I'll tell you, all the internal evidence I've identified is consistent with, or even proof of, Joseph Smith's authorship. I intend to cover 5 of many anomalies today, all based on internal evidence. The first one relates to the language used by Jesus, and the second to the language used by the 3 major writers, Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni. The third anomaly relates to the prophecies, made mostly by Nephi and also by others. The 4th and 5th relate to the proper names and the long generations. Thank you, Joe. The first anomaly relates to the 2 Jesuses in the Book of Mormon. As all of you know, the Book of Mormon is essentially a 1,000-year history of a group of Israelites who leave Jerusalem in 600 B.C. They split into two groups, the faithful Nephites and the rebellious Lamanites. The two sides constantly war with each other, culminating in a final civil war around 400 CE, in which the Nephites are wiped out and the Lamanites survive as Native Americans. About 634 years into this thousand-year history, that is in about 34 CE, Jesus visits the people after his resurrection. His visit is covered in chapters 9 through 28 of the book of 3 Nephi. During his visit, he delivers in chapters 12 through 14 his familiar Sermon on the Mount, and this is referred to as the Sermon at the Temple by BYU Law Professor John Welch, and in my remarks today. I will refer to the person who delivered the sermon at the temple as the biblical Jesus. In chapters 9 through 11 and 15 through 28, Jesus preaches many other things to the same audience and to his 12 disciples. In these 17 chapters, Jesus' teachings are unique to the Book of Mormon, and I will refer to them, to this Jesus, as the Book of Mormon Jesus. The biblical Jesus speaks about 2,500 words in his sermon at the temple. Sorry about that. And the Book of Mormon Jesus speaks about 8,000 words, not counting his quotations of Isaiah and other biblical sources. Now, I'm sorry if that sounds technical, but that's the nature of internal evidence. You do have to get into detail, but the slides, I think, are intended to kind of summarize my points. In comparing what the two Jesuses say and how they say it, we may well conclude from their differences that they are not the same person. I will describe some of the differences between them before I identify a major anomaly. The first difference is in how they refer to God the Father. They are both alike in referring to him as Father, but referring to God as Father is not uncommon throughout the Book of Mormon. The biblical Jesus refers to him 17 times and always with a personal, my Father, our Father, thy Father, or your Father. The Book of Mormon Jesus refers to him 132 times, using my Father 8 times, but the impersonal the Father 124 times. The biblical Jesus never refers to God impersonally as the Father. Furthermore, the biblical Jesus, more than half the time, that is 10 of 17 references, refers to the Father as Father which is in heaven or Heavenly Father. The Book of Mormon Jesus never refers to the Father as Father which is in heaven or Heavenly Father. Incidentally, the Book of Mormon Jesus is just like Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni in their respective narratives, referring to God as the Father. Now again, I apologize for all the detail, but that's the nature of the evidence we're talking about. A second difference between the two Jesuses is how they address the crowd. Even though they are each speaking to the same audience, the biblical Jesus never defines his audience as the Book of Mormon Jesus does. The biblical Jesus refers to the audience simply in the second person, ye, you, but the Book of Mormon Jesus refers to them as, O house of Israel. He settles on this term in chapter 10 before he appears in person to the people in chapter 11. The people hear his voice in chapter 10, calling them first, in verse 4, O ye people of these great cities which have fallen, who are descendants of Jacob, yea, who are of the house of Israel. In the next three verses, he progressively shortens it. In verse 5, it becomes, O ye people of the house of Israel who have fallen. And then, O ye people of the house of Israel. In verse 9, the voice shortens it again to, O ye house of Israel. And finally in verse 7, to, O house of Israel. Jesus appears in person in chapter 11 and gives his sermon at the temple in chapters 12 through 14 without once addressing his audience as, O house of Israel. In chapter 16, the Book of Mormon, Jesus picks up his salutation again, addressing the crowd as, O house of evil, O house of Israel. Sorry about that. O house of Israel, let's see, where am I? Oh, yes. In chapter 16, he picks up his salutation again, addressing the crowd as, O house of Israel, seven times. He addresses them again as, O house of Israel, three times in chapter 20 and four times in chapter 21. In short, the Book of Mormon addresses his audience 19 times as of the house of Israel. He does this five times before and 14 times after the biblical Jesus delivers the sermon at the temple. Although he is speaking to the same audience, the biblical Jesus never addresses the people as of the house of Israel. A third difference relates to the infrequently used words. More than half of the 5,250 different words in the Book of Mormon are used only three times or less. In fact, there are 1,569 of these 5,250 different words in the Book of Mormon that are used just once in the entire book. Except for the minor writers like Omni, Ammaron, Chemosh, and Abinadam, all writers of the Book of Mormon use words that are found only once in the Book of Mormon. Of these, the biblical Jesus uses 38 of them, while the Book of Mormon Jesus uses only 15, even though he is quoted more than three times as much as the biblical Jesus. And you can see the words there that the respective Jesuses use. In other words, the biblical Jesus uses one of these words for every 66 words, or more than seven per page. In contrast, the Book of Mormon Jesus uses one for every 533 words, or slightly less than one per page. The biblical Jesus, in fact, uses his unique vocabulary about eight times more frequently than the Book of Mormon Jesus does. These data can be refined because many of these words used only once have variations used elsewhere. For example, Nephi alone uses abridged once, but he and Mormon also use abridgment, and Moroni uses abridging. But many words used but once do not have variations. Of these, the Book of Mormon Jesus uses seven of them, and the biblical Jesus uses 21. Indeed, the biblical Jesus uses these words over nine times more frequently on average than the Book of Mormon Jesus does. A fourth and last difference that I'll mention is that the Book of Mormon Jesus sounds not like the biblical Jesus, but like Nephi, Jacob, and Mormon, and Moroni in his use of their idiom. This is true throughout his preaching. As just one example, he says that, yeah, you've got the verse there. He says, for thus it behooveth the Father that it should come forth from the Gentiles, that he may show forth his power unto the Gentiles for this cause, that the Gentiles, if they will not harden their hearts, that they may repent and come unto me and be baptized in my name and know the true points of my doctrine, that they may be numbered among my people, O house of Israel. Here we see the Book of Mormon Jesus using common Book of Mormon idiom. He uses a superfluous forth with come, as in come forth, and show forth, numbered meaning counted, and O. He uses five idiomatic phrases in this one sentence, such as, "For thus it behooveth the Father," sounding like Nephi and Mormon, who say that it behooveth God three times. Joe, have you shown the other four? Yeah, this is a Book of Mormon idiom, that he may show forth his power for this cause, that if they will not harden their hearts and know the true points of my doctrine. All of these phrases are used by more than one writer of the Book of Mormon. These four differences between the two Jesuses are not the only differences, but they're enough for now. They are in contrast to one major anomaly. Both Jesuses use, "Verily, verily, I say unto you," many times. One LDS scholar refers to "verily" as one of the generally accepted characteristics of the very voice of Jesus. And thus, and this would seem to be true, "verily" is used 76 times in the Book of Mormon, and the two Jesuses together use this adverb with the expression, "I say unto you," 70 times, 70 of 76 times. The biblical Jesus uses "verily" 21 times, and the Book of Mormon Jesus 49 times. Since the two Jesuses are otherwise so different, their heavy usage of "verily, verily, I say unto you" may have been by design. It is not hard to imagine that when Joseph Smith came to Jesus' appearance in the New World, he recognized the daunting challenge of making the Book of Mormon Jesus sound like the familiar biblical Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount. He may have hit on the simple expedient of using the expression, "Verily, verily, I say unto you," this very voice of Jesus, for the purpose of making the two Jesuses sound alike. He used the expression with abandon, much as an impersonator exaggerates a mannerism of his subject. There is evidence to suggest this. The biblical Jesus uses this idiom only five times in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew. These five have all been retained in the Book of Mormon sermon, but 16 more have been added. Furthermore, one of the original five has been changed to a double, "verily, verily." This change in the 16 additions suggests an emphasis on this idiomatic expression. Also, although Jesus uses "verily" only singly in his Sermon on the Mount, in the Book of Mormon, the biblical Jesus uses a double "verily, verily" eight times. And the Book of Mormon, Jesus uses a double "verily, verily" 15 times. I'll read you this parenthetic expression I have here. Parenthetically, in the Bible, Jesus uses a double "verily, verily" only in the Gospel of John and not in Matthew, where the Sermon on the Mount is found. The double and frequent "verily, verily" also suggests an emphasis. Readers could hardly miss how Jesus sounds the same in this respect throughout his visit. One thing that can be learned from this exercise, I believe, is that an examination of the words used by writers can distinguish one writer from another. That's not a surprise, actually, as in the case of the two Jesuses, or contrarywise, a close examination of the words used by the several writers can determine whether the writers are the same or different. Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni all use the same idiom, the same words and phrases throughout the book. For example, I have identified 27 words that seem to be idiomatic, 9 of which are recognizably biblical. And they are "behold," "yea," "even," "forth," "O," "cast," "hearken," "woe," and "lest." Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni use them all, even though Mormon and Moroni write more than 900 years after Nephi. It seems unlikely that the idiom would not change over this period, especially when we think back on how much the English language has changed in the past 900 years or so. This is particularly true of words like behold and yea, which are superfluous. Okay, let's turn to a second anomaly, relating not to a single word like verily, but to two words, therefore and wherefore. Each of them is frequently used, therefore being used over 650 times in the Book of Mormon, and wherefore over 400 times. The two words are interchangeable with few exceptions. Together they are ubiquitous, occurring about 2.5 times per page on average. By way of comparison, the phrase, and it came to pass, and its variations, which we associate so much with the Book of Mormon, are used nearly 3 times per page. Therefore and wherefore together are nearly as ubiquitous as and it came to pass. There are only 6 instances in which wherefore cannot be substituted for therefore. And all 6 instances are in statements made by the biblical Jesus, such as after this manner, therefore pray ye. One cannot say after this manner, wherefore pray ye. Incidentally, this is one more difference between the two Jesuses. The distribution of therefore and wherefore within the Book of Mormon is fascinating. Good. That block you see there is the Book of Mormon. The main writer, Mormon, uses therefore much more than he uses wherefore, whereas the other two major writers of the Book of Mormon, Nephi and Moroni, Nephi is over that darker color over there, gray. And Moroni is this lighter gray. They use wherefore. I don't know. Oh, yeah, this is wherefore, and therefore. That's a strange distribution. The main writer, as I say, uses therefore much more than he uses wherefore, whereas the other major writers of the Book of Mormon, Nephi and Moroni, who open and close the book, use wherefore significantly more than therefore. More specifically, Mormon's abridgments constitute nearly 2/3 of the Book of Mormon and contain 90% of the therefores, but less than 3% of the wherefores. The writings of Nephi and Moroni, together with the several minor writers following Nephi, and you remember the several minor writers over there following Nephi, comprise the remaining 1/3 of the Book of Mormon and are just the opposite of Mormon. They use only 10% of the therefores and over 97% of the wherefores. These data would seem to challenge the notion of a single writer of the Book of Mormon. Indeed, some scholars once considered this as evidence of different writers, but they have since abandoned the idea. The anomaly is in the way therefore and wherefore are distributed within the writings of Mormon and Moroni. With respect to Mormon, again, who uses therefore overwhelmingly, he uses only wherefore in the two things he wrote outside of his abridgments. He wrote words of Mormon, there it is, the 2-page bridge between the books of Omni and Mosiah. He uses only wherefore 4 times in the words of, he uses only wherefore 4 times in the words of Mormon in the chapters leading up to the book of Mosiah. There are 17 pages, including words of Mormon, containing 30 wherefores, but no therefores. But in the book of Mosiah, which follows words of Mormon and begins Mormon's abridgments, the first 28 pages contain 57 therefores without a single wherefore. It seems extremely unlikely that an author would by happenstance use 30 straight wherefores and suddenly switch to 57 straight therefores. With respect to Mormon's other writing outside his abridgments, he wrote 2 letters to his son Moroni, which Moroni included in his book of Moroni, the final book in the Book of Mormon. In the Book of Moroni, where Moroni uses only wherefore, Mormon uses wherefore in his two letters 11 times, and no therefore, sounding just like Moroni and unlike himself throughout his abridgments. This, then, is the anomaly within the writings of Mormon. Outside of his abridgments, in which he uses therefore overwhelmingly, he uses only wherefore in words of Mormon and his two letters to Moroni. Similarly, in Mormon's individual Book of Mormon, Mormon's final book, and in which he uses only therefore, now we're talking about the small Book of Mormon right there. Moroni writes the last two chapters, you recall that, and like Mormon before him, uses only therefore four times. To recap, wherefore predominates from Nephi and Jacob through Mormon's words of Mormon, then beginning with Mormon's abridgments with the Book of Mosiah, therefore predominates right through Mormon's own Book of Mormon, including Moroni's final two chapters of this book. Then beginning with Moroni's Book of Moroni, including Mormon's two letters, wherefore is used exclusively to the end of the book. In short, what determines which word is used is not the writer, but where it is used in the book. Remember that after the loss of the 116 pages, Joseph Smith began dictating the Book of Mormon from Mosiah. That's right at the beginning of the Brown there, through to the end of the book, ending with Moroni's Book of Moroni, and then returned to the beginning of the book and proceeded from the Book of Nephi through Mormon's words of Mormon. So therefore occurs in the first part of the dictation, beginning with Book of Mosiah, and wherefore occurs in the last part of the dictation from the Book of Moroni through words of Mormon. What is missing in this summary thus far is the Book of Ether, which follows Mormon's Book of Mormon with a predominance of therefores and precedes Mormon's Book of Moroni with exclusively wherefores. It is in the Book of Ether that a changeover occurs from therefore to wherefore. In the first chapter of Ether, therefore occurs twice and wherefore not at all. In the second chapter, each word appears twice. When we arrive at the 10th of 15 chapters, there are no therefores, but six wherefores. There are also no therefores in chapters 11, 13, and 14, and only one each in chapters 12 and 15, while each of these chapters uses wherefore. By the end of the Book of Ether, there has been a gradual changeover from a total of 24 therefores to 63 wherefores. Incidentally, even though Moroni and Nephi use 10% of the therefores, most of them are found in the Book of Ether and in the 13 chapters from Isaiah that Nephi included in his writings. So it's a little misleading to talk about Moroni and Nephi using 10% of the therefores. Now, these data demand an explanation, and the easiest one for me is that the odd distribution was by Joseph Smith's design, although it may be hard to believe. Why would Joseph Smith make such a subtle change, one that probably not even a careful reader would discover? If no one would notice it, why do it? But there is reason to believe that this is what he did. Just after the author started the Book of Ether, he recognized that Moroni would be abridging the Jaredite record and that he and Mormon would somehow have to sound different, just as he recognized in 3 Nephi that the two Jesuses would have to sound the same. But how? There was no very voice of Mormon or very voice of Moroni. Joseph Smith couldn't change his whole writing style, and he had already used his idiom abundantly, like beginning sentences with behold and yea. Distinguishing between Mormon and Moroni would not be easy. He may have recognized that he had used therefore commonly throughout Mormon's abridgments, and that he had a ready substitute in wherefore. Indeed, the idea may have occurred to him just after dictating the first chapter of Ether, where he used therefore twice, but not wherefore. In the second chapter, he used each word twice, and eventually began to use wherefore more and more frequently. He continually slipped back to his customary therefore as he dictated the book of Ether, but by the end of the book, he had pretty much mastered the change. Using therefore only twice in the last six chapters of the book of Ether, while using wherefore 38 times. He gave it no more thought during the rest of his dictation. Thus, he didn't change wherefore to therefore in Mormon's two letters or in the later words of Mormon. What this suggests, I believe, like we saw earlier with verily I say unto you, is consciousness on the author's part of what he was doing. Might be hard to believe, but I don't know what other explanation there is. The distribution of therefore and wherefore does not seem to be divinely inspired. Okay, let's move to a third anomaly, which does not involve words, but prophecies. There are many prophecies. There you go. About 40% of them have to do with events in world history that had already occurred when Joseph Smith dictated the book. I'll refer to these as past events. About one-third relate to events still to occur when Joseph Smith dictated the book, and I'll refer to these as future events. The remaining one-quarter or so relate to events within the book's narrative. I'll refer to these as internal events. The anomaly is that the prophecies of past and internal events differ from the prophecies of future events. With respect to the prophecies of past events, they are specific and unconditional, as if born of 2020 hindsight. They describe events unconditionally destined to occur, as they all, in fact, had occurred by 1830. An example of prophecies of past events is Lehi's and or Nephi's prophecies that in 600 years the Lord God would raise up among the Jews a savior of the world who would be born of a virgin in Nazareth to a woman named Mary, that his name would be Jesus Christ, that he would be baptized in Bethabara beyond the Jordan River, that he would select 12 apostles and heal the sick, that the Jews would not believe his gospel and would slay him, and that he would rise from the dead after 3 days. One anomaly within prophecies of past events is that names and places of sacred history are foreknown, like Mary, Jesus, Bethabara, and Nazareth, but not the names in secular history, like Columbus, who is, quote, a man among the Gentiles, and will discover the promised land, or the Atlantic Ocean, which is the many waters on which other Gentiles will go forth to the promised land. Prophecies of internal events, by and large, clearly and accurately describe the subsequent Book of Mormon history, which had already been dictated when the prophecies were made, such as the appearance of Jesus in the promised land, the final civil war between the Nephites and the Lamanites, the destruction of the Nephites, and the survival of the Lamanites. By and large, the prophecies of internal events, like the prophecies of past events, are specific descriptions of events that subsequently and unmistakably occurred within the Book of Mormon narrative. Two major themes recur in the prophecies of future events. The first is the restoration of the house of Israel to the lands of their inheritance, which, unlike the prophecies of past events, is conditional, the most explicit of which is Jacob's quoting the Lord. When the day cometh that they, the Jews, shall believe in me, that I am Christ, then have I covenanted with their fathers that they shall be restored in the flesh upon the earth unto the lands of their inheritance. So when the Jews accept Jesus as the Christ, which is the condition, Then they will be restored to the lands of their inheritance, that is, Israel. So, the present state of Israel is not the promised restoration, but as Marion G. Romney said in 1981 in a general conference address, the state of Israel is a, quote, signal that the Jews would soon come to accept Jesus Christ as their Redeemer. The second theme is the carrying forth of the Book of Mormon to the Native Americans, to the rest of the world, which was within the control of Joseph Smith and his followers, such as that when the Book of Mormon comes forth, there shall be many which shall believe the words which are written, and they shall carry them forth unto the remnant of the seed of the people of Nephi. Other prophecies of future events are extrapolations of conditions existing in Joseph Smith's time, such as that the Gentiles will not destroy the seed of Nephi's brothers, that is, the Native Americans. Many prophecies are eschatological, describing the end times in familiar Christian terms, such as that the Holy One of Israel numbereth his sheep, and there shall be one fold and one shepherd, and Satan has no power and cannot be loosed for the space of many years. And many of the prophecies are general, whose meaning is unclear, such as Nephi's prophecy of the destruction of all nations that fight against the 12 apostles. What do these terms mean? The prophecies of future events are unimpressive in content and stand in sharp contrast to the prophecies of past events, which are largely specific, unconditional, and unambiguous. The prophecies of internal events are not much less so. The difference between specific, accurate prophecies and vague, less accurate prophecies is a key to scriptural scholars in determining when the prophecies were written, which would be in the early 19th century. There appear to be no prophecies in the Book of Mormon that the author could not have made. The last two anomalies are the shortest. The fourth anomaly occurs in the proper names. According to the Book of Mormon account, Lehi's party consisted of Jews who spoke Hebrew and left Jerusalem for the New World in 600 BC. The Jaredites, on the other hand, left the Tower of Babel in today's Iraq for the New World in about 2200 to 3100 BC. Mormon scholars differ on the date of the Tower of Babel, which is a fiction anyway. And they spoke an unconfounded language. It was just the pure Adamic language. Again, scholars disagree. In any case, the two peoples came from different parts of the world, at least 1,600 years apart, did not interact except for one person for 9 months, and spoke different languages. And yet they have seven identical names. There you have them. Identical names. Both peoples have them. And they have 14 others that are nearly identical. That is, within one letter of each other. And here, Joe's going to put them up again. It seems highly unusual that these two peoples would share any name. We come to the last anomaly, a fifth one. Some Jaredites lived long lives. Corianton dies at age 142, and five kings beget children in their old age. Another has a child at an exceeding old age, another at an exceedingly great age, and two others at a good old age. I speculate that the author may have believed in the long lives noted in the Old Testament, including Methuselah, the longest lived of the patriarchs, who lived 969 years. But the long lives are also found among the Nephites, whose history comes long after the Old Testament patriarchs. Indeed, there are three instances of long lives among the Nephites. First, several times in the Book of Mormon, the period from Jesus' birth to the final civil war that destroyed the Nephites is stated to be both 400 years and four generations. But if a new generation begins every 25 years or so, 400 years would equal 16 generations and not four. Could the author of the Book of Mormon have equated one generation with 100 years? Possibly. Fourth Nephi notes that after 110 years, the first generation from Christ had passed away. And that after 200 years, the second generation had passed away except for a few. Now, I'm speculating that the author may have assumed that someone born at the beginning of each new century would live at least 100 years and added their ages together to arrive at four generations or 400 years. But a father's and son's ages are not added together since their lives overlap for much of their lives. Thus, if a father is 25 when his son is born and dies when he is 72, their lives would overlap for 47 years. Here's the second instance of long lives among the Nephites. Nephi's younger brother Jacob gives the plates to his son Enos, who writes that 179 years had passed since Lehi left Jerusalem, which was at most 7 years before Jacob was born. So Jacob's and his son Enos's lives spanned at least 172 years. Enos gives the plates to his son Jerem, who is Jacob's grandson, and writes that 238 years had passed away. So Jacob's and his grandson Jerem's lives spanned at least 231 years. Jerem gives the plates to his son Omni, Jacob's great-grandson, who writes that 282 years had passed away. So Jacob's and his great-grandson Omni's lives spanned at least 275 years, which is 11 generations and not four. We have to guess the age of these four persons since their ages are not given in the text. So let's guess that the father in each generation is, say, 50 years old, rather than 25 when his son is born and his wife is still of childbearing age. Under this scenario, Jacob's son would live to be about 122, Jacob's grandson 131, and the great-grandson 125. Presumably to avoid these ultra-long lives, BYU law professor Jack Welch suggests that rather than 50, Jacob was probably about 63, Enos 77, Jerem 70, and Omni 50 when their sons were born, and, I must say, to much younger wives. Other apologetic scholars simply observe that many Nephites live to a rather old age. Finally, the third instance of long lives among the Nephites occurs following Jesus' visit in the book of 4th Nephi. There are four authors of this book. The son of the Nephi who wrote the third book of Nephi, whose name is also Nephi and is the only Nephi in 4th Nephi. Nephi's son Amos, and Amos's two sons, Amos and Ammaron, who are grandsons of Nephi. The three generations from Nephi to his grandson, Ammaron, are even longer than those from Jacob to his great-grandson. According to the dates given in the book of 4th Nephi, if the father in each of these generations is 50 years old when his son is born, then Nephi lives to be about 96. His son Amos lives to be 130. Nephi's grandson Amos lives to be 191 years. And Nephi's other grandson, Ammaron, lives to be at least 206 years. Something is obviously wrong, but their shortest possible lives occur if they are all born in the year their father dies, although the mother would be much younger than the father and the son would have to grow up before he could keep the record. In this scenario, the two grandsons would live to be 111 and 126. There are many more anomalies than these five. They are found from a close examination of the book itself. This is not to say that I do not appreciate external evidence. The many books and articles I've read about linguistics, biographies, history, archaeology, DNA, and so forth are fascinating, and by and large reflect good scholarship. This is the kind of evidence most people are familiar with, but none of it seems to be dispositive of the question of how we got the Book of Mormon. What comes closest, I believe, is the internal evidence, which is complete, as I've said, accessible, unchanging, and certain. In this paper, I've tried to give you a taste of what is available within the book itself. For those of us who do not base their beliefs on faith, but turn to evidence, I believe that the internal evidence will play a larger and larger role in our search for truth. Thank you. Thank you. I guess we have 5 minutes for any question.
Oh, we have more time. We've got just 15. But before you do that, you have books here, don't you?
Yeah.
And where are they?
They're out at the desk in the front hall. Yeah, if anyone wants one. Questions? Yeah, Joe? Just a minute, Joe. They're bringing around a...
Well, we need it recorded.
It seemed to me, Earl, in the wherefore, therefore, that at the same time that that changes in ether, that Joseph Smith's revelations that he was having outside the Book of Mormon also changes. Am I remembering correctly?
I don't know.
I think Brent Metcalf deals with that in his article.
Does he?
I'm pretty sure.
I know he deals with wherefore and therefore. The ether book in particular.
Right, that's his priority of Mosiah is what he uses.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that might be another explanation. I just don't know.
Okay.
So just continuing on the therefore, wherefore, have you done any research on possibly Oliver Cowdery's the one writing therefore and Joseph Smith's the one writing wherefore?
No. No.
Because if you could look at other writings, you know, by Oliver Cowdery outside the Book of Mormon and other writings by Joseph Smith outside the Book of Mormon, I wonder if you'd see that one uses therefore in everyday speech and one uses wherefore. Just a thought.
It's a thought.
Yeah.
It's a thought. I mean, I could follow up on it, but I don't intend to.
Anybody else?
Thanks, Earl. You mentioned the, and it came to pass, as one of the distinguishing phrases of the Book of Mormon. Do you have anything else to share about that in terms of what it says to us? Because I'm just reading through the Book of Mormon for the first time, being a non-Mormon, I'm curious about it. And it seems like that occurs in Nephi especially, at the beginning of almost every verse.
Yeah.
And it came to passes and the yeas, if there's anything that you can share with us about that.
There were, you know, what I've done is identified what seems to be a problem, but and I've read a lot of apologetic works that address any number of things in the Book of Mormon, but I don't remember anything that addresses that. Sorry about that.
Seems like just lazy writing.
Yeah, that's the explanation I've heard many times.
Well, my understanding is too that they've deleted a lot of them from the book, and someone. Oh, well, I guess it was me that said this.
Oh,
Someone at BYU said that, and it came to pass, was probably a single word in the Hebrew or the Reformed Egyptian or whatever. But I would counter that it's not just "and it came to pass," because "and it came to pass" comes in many ways. I mean, and it will come to pass, therefore it came to pass, or whatever. I mean, there are lots of different ways. I've got them in my book here, but I don't have that box. This is the A to C, A to C-O-M. Yeah. Anything else? Have I answered everything?
Let's do this one and one more.
I'm curious about you. I'd like to know how you... This is fascinating. You have obviously spent hours and hours and years examining these things. And what brought you to a place, who are you, that would bring you to a place where you would do this for us? And thank you.
I'm just an ordinary person. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in Salt Lake, raised Mormon, did not go on a mission, studied overseas for a couple of years and was in the service a couple of years, but then... As I've said in my paper, in my early 20s, I wondered about the Book of Mormon. And I don't know what caused that, but I did. And that got me into this. As I say, in 1976, after 14 years, I had come up with this. That leaves a lot of years between 76 and today. And I had a full-time job, of course, and didn't spend all my time on this, but spend a substantial amount of time. I've given 10 or so presentations at Sunstone, so that took a little writing and effort. I've written two articles that have been published in Dialogue, one challenging the limited geography theory and one challenging chiasmus. I've tried to draft a book at least five times, I think. I've come up with five different drafts, five different titles, and this finally worked. What else can I say? I'm married. I've got two sons who are both married with two children, so I'm a grandfather four times.
Who had their hand up over here?
What? No, not at all. I'm out. I'm the only one out. Yeah, the others are happy and in, and one of my sons went on a mission.
I just wanted to say thank you for your extensive study on this. It helps clarify a lot of things, or at least can lead to further understanding of the Book of Mormon. But I wanted to ask you what you thought of the... repetition that you find in the Book of Mormon so often. It's just repetitive thoughts, repetitive phrases, repetitive, extensive repetition, and just what your thoughts were on that.
Well, I don't know. I haven't addressed that in anything I've written, but I would guess that it's a reflection of a human limitation. I think the author... I think the author was brilliant, but limited, like we all are as human beings, and could come up with just so many ideas, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what else to say about that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, no. I've always found it odd that as you're reading in different books or different chapters, you'll find that the repetition, he will say something, a thought, and then he'll repeat it again in a little different way, and he'll repeat it again in another different way. And I just, I find it odd. It's almost like filler.
Yeah, well, I think I probably identified a lot of those things as idiom, Book of Mormon idiom that's repeated. I mean, any phrase or anything like that that's repeated is usually repeated in some other author too. And so you've got a Book of Mormon idiom that reflects a single person.
I don't know if you've noticed, is it throughout every book that the same thing happens? I mean, do you find those same idioms from the first book?
Many of them.
So
yeah. 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 There are some idioms that are used twice, is all. They're used by two different authors, or if one author does it, then that counts for the uniqueness of that author. And so I would have to count that. But very often when that happens, it happens within verses of each other when you've got one author repeating one thing. Other times it's way apart. Nothing occurs to me right now, but I've got a lot of them in the book here.
Briefly,
real quickly.
We have to get out of here.
You refer to the authorship of Joseph Smith. I'm prone to do the same thing. But, you know, as you know, many Mormons will use the stupid farm boy excuse. So, what do you think of, like, the Spalding Rigdon theory or other theories about, do you examine that at all?
Not really. What I've read about it, I mean, other scholars have challenged that, and I'm willing to accept that, you know, Joseph Smith was all that was left, and that he was really, you know, he was prepared. He told his family all about the Indians that lived here in the evening, and he was well versed in the Bible, and he had written some scripture, if you will. Before he dictated the Book of Mormon. So he had that capacity. He was very familiar with the Bible. So I think he had the capability, and he had the imagination, and he had the audacity to do it. Yeah, okay.
We need to leave. Oh. Thank you so much.